It always seems like a, well, I don't know, it doesn't always, but it often seems like a good idea to talk about how we keep going this time of year. Not to be too hackneyed, but nonetheless, a lot of people think of the beginning of the year as a beginning, and it's a good time to kind of take a look at your oars and see if they're on the water and how this is going. So what I'd like to share is, because I've thought about this a lot, keeping going, and, you know, it's like this practice thing we do, it's kind of like learning to play the violin in a way. I mean, in the beginning, you get a lot of squawks, and it's just uncomfortable and ridiculous. But then, over in masterhood, you know, really having music, that takes time, and it takes uncomfortableness and embarrassment. But the end result is sublime and transcendent. And so there's this parallel there. But I looked it up. There's a daunting statistic. 90% of the people who start playing the violin quit. So only 10% continue. And I have no idea, you know, what the statistics are for people doing practice, but I definitely see, you know, sort of sitting in this seat over 21 years, see people come and go. You know, people show up for a while and they're really interested and then they vanish. And of course, they may be practicing somewhere else. So I'm not saying this is, you know, obviously this is not the only place, but then often people show up and they have not been practicing, they say, and they want to get started again. And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. And it's hard. I totally get it. It's hard. But there's other people, and some of them are here, who just keep practicing and they just keep practicing and they don't give up. And it's accumulative. And over time, change happens to those who continue. It kind of sneaks up on cat's feet. You know, it kind of surprises you. You realize, oh, my mind's different. Oh, something just opened. And it didn't even feel like sometimes like anything was happening, like it was the worst time. And then there'll be this little clearing because we stayed in there during the worst time. And then the mist clears just because we stayed in. So I want to explore a little bit about some of the, you know, there's a little bit my own sense of things, but pulling from sources, but some of what's hard for people in practice, maybe it'll resonate for you a little bit here and there. And then what we can do, some thoughts about to continue. And, you know, this isn't a new question here in 2022. I mean, it's one the Buddha faced with monks and lay people at his time. And of course, it's an issue for people on the path, whatever their tradition, around the world. But it's crazy when you think of the Buddha's time, and there were monastics with him, around him, day after day, and they could see this, the magnificence of this fully realized being. And some of them still needed to be cajoled. There's one sutta called the two kinds of thought discourse and the connected discourses. And towards the end, the Buddha says to a group of lagging monastics, what should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them, that I have done for you, monastics. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, monastics. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. So he couldn't make them do it. He just pointed, you know, or else you regret it later. That's as heavy-handed as he ever gets. But it's true. And I just love the simplicity of that. You know, it's like roots of trees, empty huts. That's like a little phrase that comes up repeatedly all through the suttas. And it just feels like, oh yeah, that's so simple. You know, roots of trees, empty huts. We got those, you know, empty hut, empty room, not much different. So we can do that. It doesn't require anything but what we do. So it seems like it's, you know, it's doable. It's doable. But we have to, in some way, engage with a sense of direction and have some sense of view and some sense of willpower or intention and kind of put all that together and keep going. So we know where we have some sense of where we're going, where we're trying to go, and some sense of how we're doing it and then bring energy to it and not get dissuaded when it doesn't feel good. Because it's not always about feeling good, but let's remember the promises the Buddha made about the practice for humble folks like us at the end of the Satipatthana Sutta, which is, you know, the where he talks about how to practice. And he says, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way for 7 months, for 6 months, for 5 months, for 4 months, for 3 months, for 2 months, for 1 month, for half a month, one of two fruits could be expected for them, either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. So I'm always amazed by that statement, because it's like a lot of us have been practicing for years, much less a month. And maybe we haven't seen that, but nonetheless, it to me, it speaks to the power of the practice and the potential and the fact that here we are 2,600 years from the time of the Buddha, and people are practicing all over the world. Therefore, something keeps working. The baton keeps being passed because something works. Well, we know it works. People wake up. So this potential of awakening is kind of like the big carrot for why we practice. And if we really do this practice, we change. But how do we get through the dry periods, the difficulties that can derail us or slow us down or frustrate us or have us reduce our energy? In Tibetan tradition, I've often heard it taught that there's an essential difference between worldly life and spiritual life. Thich Nhat Hanh Rinpoche, I couldn't find where he did it, but he has some brilliant teachings about this. And the succinct, the essence is, worldly life, it is said, is easy in the beginning and hard in the end, whereas spiritual life is hard in the beginning and easy in the end. And that's actually amazing. I'll decode what that means a little bit, at least as I understand it. I mean, you know, sometimes, especially as, you know, an old person, I'll be around some or see some young people, and, you know, they're 22 and they're handsome, they're beautiful, they're whatever. And there's this kind of like certain smug kind of happiness, or there's a certain, that you can see people framing like the way they, their whole body English, they know they're attractive. So they do these little things because they're attractive and people look at them because they're attractive and they're doing this I'm attractive thing. And that's cool. And so we see them at the peak of their curve, you know? Things are so pleasant right now, so they're just rolling with it. But they're not actually planning ahead very much, because this kind of happy smugness, it just doesn't deepen over the years. In fact, it erodes. And that's, for one thing, why celebrities and rich people seem to have kind of difficult lives often later on. And then especially towards the end of life, for persons who have posited their sense of that, got a sense of happiness on that, it gets a little grim. Many decades ago, I worked in a nursing home for a while, and I learned a lot. And I remember well these people I got to know, these aged people, elders, who had lost their looks, lost their attractiveness, lost all that stuff, and they used to have it. You know, they told me I was beautiful. I was handsome. They had it, and they lost it, and they were kind of mystified, and some of them were bitter. I mean, they were really struggling, you know, because they didn't have it anymore, and they hadn't looked deeply. They were, you know, maybe they didn't realize it, but they based their sense of direction upon that in various ways. But on the other hand, spiritual life is difficult in the beginning just because we're beginning, because we're headed in a direction that we can't quite see yet. It's like we have to step out on a path that leads us to fruit that we can't realize until we're there. It's this sort of paradox. It's almost like going blindly in a direction that we haven't realized. And when we sit to practice, we're often mired in our own attachments, our traumas, our conditionings, all this stuff that looms up. In fact, it looms up more when we sort of step out of the entertainments that normally keep us distracted and just look. And when we just look, it's like, whoa, we end up seeing our stuff. And there's that stuff that a lot of people spend a lot of time not looking at, but there it is. and it often isn't fun. And it can take some time before we start to find freedom in practice, before we find the difficult bits of our trauma and our conditioning kind of falling away and fading. And to cultivate awareness, mindfulness, when it's uncomfortable, when we're faced with our own complications, is hard. And it may seem for many of us at times like something's wrong with us, or it may seem like this is the furthest thing from this idyllic spirituality that we had in mind. But the truth is, often, this is where we grow the most. Just showing up just where it sucks. That can be the lift to get through something. And it takes a while, you know, for equanimity to blossom, for loving kindness to emerge, for not clinging to happen. But it does. It does on the path, and life gets more joyful and easy in the end. And people that are, you know, I've been around some really elderly practitioners, and their bodies are shot. You know, nothing's working. And they're kind of Arya Dhaka. He was someone I knew years and years and years ago. He was the first, I think I've mentioned some of you, but he was the first paid Buddhist chaplain in the Washington, in any prison system in the United States. He was a paid, Washington State, had the first paid Buddhist chaplain. And he was dying of, what do you call it? I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, he was dying. And he just had, I mean, he was dying and he was, you know, dealt with it. But he just had this loveliness right to the very end. It was just amazing. And he had really brought a lot of fruit in his practice. From the Dhammapada, number 24, it says, those who are energetically committed to the way, who are pure and considerate in effort, composed and virtuous in conduct, steadily increase in radiance. Isn't that great? They steadily increase in radiance. And that's just peeling away the muck, you know? So, one way of understanding what's, you know, where the path is taking us is developing equanimity. It's the most wisdom-based of the Brahma-Viharas. It means that we're in the present regardless of inner and outer conditions. And this is sort of the big, well, just what Goldie was talking about, you know, sort of part of the big payoff is to be completely present when things go nuts. And you never know when they are. But to learn that, we have to do a lot of practice when things feel like they're nuts to be able to get to that place. And that means often, you know, remaining fully aware, cultivating awareness in the middle of changing and sometimes difficult conditioning. And so it's hard at the beginning. It's hard at the beginning. So there's three, three areas of obstacles that we might explore a little bit and see if something clicks for you: outer distractions, inner distractions, and losing track of inspiration, of what keeps us going. You know, those three areas, when I look at people, part of what derails them is often one of those three or some combination of them. So outer distractions, I mean, even 2022, I guess that's how you say it. It's kind of ridiculous in terms of outer distractions. I mean, it gets, you know, ridiculouser and ridiculouser as technology advances, if that is the right term. I'm not sure it is. But as technology develops, because there's all these things pulling us away. I mean, it's just, anyway, I won't say that, but there's just a huge industry completely committed to distracting you and getting you to watch, binge, buy, all that stuff. So it's technology seems like magic too. I mean, that's part of what's hard, because there is a certain magic in this spiritual path, but the technology magic is so bright and punchy and kind of easy to access that it kind of obscures the inner magic for some people. I think that's part of why there's a You know, even though the possibility of spiritual awakening is, in a certain sense, in our culture, at the same time as a real move to the secular out there, because it's hard for people to see with all this stuff. And then for a lot of, you know, I'm retired, but some of you are working, and there's all that complication of earning livelihoods and all the attention and the pressure that all the technology adds to it. And it's hard to sit down and practice. But in terms of outer stuff, as our, you know, that's sort of the heart of the beginning part. But as our practice develops and deepens, it starts to get clearer that there's nothing worth getting attached to. And that's sort of almost like a blessing about this sort of the ridiculous consumer entertainment drenching of the 21st century, is after a while, it starts to get kind of transparent that all this stuff is useless. We start to see through it. And so that's kind of a key in my mind to how we work through this, is to really bring that into our practice, to work with it, all the distractions, everything that takes us away from just our practice, and see how we can unpack that and change that. And the word renunciation is interesting and kind of useful here, as we start to understand it on an inner level, because people often think of renunciation as something like enforced, you know, like some monastic situation or whatever, requiring us to abandon fun time for grueling and self-denying requirements of spiritual life. But actually, renunciation, it evolves. It happens from the inside out. And as we start to see that outer things just kind of don't matter, then things start to fall away, and the clinging starts to fall away. And this happens through practice. And, you know, we'll be tugged and jerked by things we want and things we don't, and comes up in our practice, comes up on the cushion, and then you start to see, oh, you start to watch it and see more deeply and just see, well, it's just a bunch of sensations. What's that about? And it falls away, and renunciation happens, and we just start to uncouple from all that stuff. And that's natural. That's natural renunciation, and it gets more and more free. And I've noticed this in kind of highly awakened beings in monastics I've had the opportunity to be around. Because when you think about their life, you kind of spend around some time and then think about how they live, you realize they're just not seeking entertainment. I mean, sometimes there's monastic vows that keep them from doing that, but they're just not doing that. They're not running around trying to have a good time, trying to have a fun time, you know, trying to be amused. They're actually radiantly happy with this moment, this moment. It's like someone, I know I've said this before, but it's such a great thing. Someone asked the Dalai Lama, Your Holiness, so some interviewer, like some regular network interviewer, and he said, Your Holiness, what was the happiest moment in your life? And there was this pause, and he said, this one. And it was like, yeah, that's great. Isn't that perfect? It's like, I mean, I mean to say this wrong, but it's like our dog, you know, our dog, like, there's all these happiest moments of our dog's life, because he's just there. So we can be like that, and we can just shed, we just let go, and it takes us to happiness. That's a beautiful thing, this inner renunciation from outward tugs. And these people, you know, I mean, these kind of very awakened beings, they're filled with this aliveness. It's not like they're flat or boring. I mean, they're filled with this sort of joy, just about the sheer act of breath after breath, moment after moment. I remember seeing some, I know I always talk about Paul Allen for some stupid reason. I think because he has a lot of yachts. He had a lot of yachts. But I saw some picture of Paul Allen standing wistfully. I think it was Octopus, which was, if I remember right, a few feet shorter than the guy who, I can't think of the other tech company, who made his yacht bigger than Paul Allen's yacht. Someone nodding, does anyone know? Yeah, in any case. But he looked so unhappy. He was just standing there, like wistfully standing on the deck of his giant yacht, looking just kind of lost. So this outer stuff, it just doesn't do it. And it's kind of in the end of the Anapanasati Sutta, the 16-step Anapanasati Sutta, which we've did a series about that, and you can look, it's great. But in the fourth tetrad, the Buddha takes the practitioner through four final steps leading to awakening. And I've been struck by the wording and how that pops up all over the suttas and starts to mean more and more, because the last four are mindfulness of breathing while contemplating impermanence, and then mindfulness of breathing while contemplating dispassion, then mindfulness of breathing while contemplating sensation, and then while contemplating release. And, you know, dispassion means not being grabbed by stuff, not having attachment to what would be passionate about. It's a letting go. And cessation is even more letting go, about our whole sense of selfing and how we relate to that. And then release is just freedom. And it seems like, I mean, it's not the whole thing, but it seems like it parallels this same area of how we relate externally. And so as we, you know, in terms of our practice, as we keep going, and we see that it doesn't matter externally, particularly, then we find ourselves moving into easy at the end, difficult at the beginning, easy at the end. And it really manifests in this arena of how we relate to outward phenomena. And it's immensely freeing, even in the bizarre, distraction cluttered world of 2022, which is, of course, only that way because we are incredibly privileged, unlike most people on the globe who aren't, they're just trying to survive. It's just we're in this strange little bubble here in the Northwest or in the United States. It's very puzzling. Okay, what about inner distractions? It's another place where people get derailed. And, you know, we've all got them. Inner distractions, they grab us. Comes with the territory of when we're not yet awakened, then inner distractions are part of our universe. And we're still identified with all these factors that make up our sense of self and all these conditionings and our traumas and our ideas about ourselves and all that stuff. And that's sort of, it's like a start where you are thing. Right? And so in our practice, we sort of walk through this, you know, Buddha's always talking about tangle. We sort of walk through this tangle or this forest of self-identity and memories and projections. And it's hard. There's one story about the Dalai Lama, I'm sure you've heard, but I always loved it, took place in the 1990 Mind and Life Conference in Dharamsala. And Sharon Salzberg asked him what he thought about self-hatred. Probably heard this story. Asked him what he thought about self-hatred. And she writes, "The room went quiet as all of us awaited the answer of the Dalai Lama, revered leader of Tibetan Buddhism. Looking startled, he turned to his translator and asked pointedly in Tibetan again and again for an explanation. Finally, turning back to me, the Dalai Lama tilted his head, his eyes narrowed in confusion. Self-hatred? He repeated in English, what is that?" So, but we all got a little bit of that maybe. But that's freedom at the end, you're seeing there. He didn't even know what it was. Just didn't even know what it was. He didn't believe in whatever conditioning he's an exile from his land. A million of his people died. He's lost power and he still doesn't have those traumas that grip him like that. So, I mean, well, I know I do. I'm just assuming we all do. Maybe some of us don't. But it's part of our inner tangle. Hard in the beginning to work with that. Hard in the beginning. And a lot of it comes down in a certain way to sort of various types of selfing. Something comes up and it seems uncomfortable. We think that's us. And therefore we don't like it. And therefore we think we're flawed. And therefore we're stuck. And maybe we'll give up. Maybe we'll go do something to divert ourselves. Maybe practice is too hard. Maybe we just sort of back down a little bit. Or, you know, don't quite step up as our Dharma journey kind of asks us to. So what do we do? You know, how do we handle that inner, And it's a subtle line in my own experience to walk here, because on the one hand, we need to be genuine with ourselves about what we're experiencing. While on the other hand, there's a freedom of letting go, and we can gain perspective there. Probably you've heard the term spiritual sidestepping. It's a real powerful term, and it refers to people turning toward an ideal of spiritual awakening and holiness or whatever, and using this to kind of avoid, to sidestep whatever they have to step up to in order to really be free. And that's one of the reasons why I'm in this particular, it's very specifically why this arena of practice, I think, is really precious, because it's really hard to do that in Vipassana practice. You just can't get away. I mean, all it is sitting there looking. So you can't get away. And I've been in other, years and years ago, without naming or anything, I've been in other spiritual groups where people were like really shiny. You know, they took on this sort of attitude of being really shiny and spiritual and walking around in flowing gowns and stuff, or saris or whatever. But they weren't dealing with their stuff. And you could see it crack open once in a while. So we kind of gotta. But both things are true, you know? It's gritty and it's sublime. Simultaneously together is how the practice unfolds on an internal area. And the more we can just kind of cop to that, you know, just accept that's how it is. It's almost like feel the joy of the problem that we're in. It's like, oh, yeah, this thing that's been tripping me up all my life, and now I'm sort of in it. But just keep showing up. And you start to see, inevitably, that there's nothing really inherently there. It's causes and conditions. It's sensations in our body. It's repeating thoughts. It's this whole matrix of stuff happening. But if we just keep showing up and just keep cultivating mindfulness in particular, that's what I mean by showing up, that we start to see it's not what we thought. It's not as rigid as we thought. There's ultimately nothing wrong. It's just a bunch of scales and layers. And it's hard in the beginning. But that's where I think it's why it's so great to be in a group and to practice with each other and get a chance to talk. Because you start to see, it's almost like AA or something, you start to see that other people articulate kind of where their sticky points are, and you say, oh, you can kind of see objectively when they talk about it, oh, well, that's not inherently them, it's just a conditioning. And it helps us see that when our sticky stuff is just a conditioning, that's part of how we help each other. We bring wisdom to this whole deal. And it's such a beautiful thing in this practice, because each one of us, the very nature of cultivating mindfulness means we're unwinding our particular skein of yarn. That's the right term, our tangle of yarn, as you go through practice. And every layer, you know, you sort of, that's why it goes in waves. You know, you sort of, sometimes you sort of get in a clear place and it's like, oh, cool, I'm tuned in now. And then something else, so we find some other way to be tangled. But over time, does lead to freedom in the end. In the Dhammapada, we read 226. I'm trying harder to actually have citations here. All pollution is cleared from the minds of those who are always vigilant, training themselves day and night, and whose lives are fully intent upon liberation. So, you know, all pollution. Isn't that great? Everything between our gnarly selves and a Buddha is pollution, and it's all cleared, is what that's saying. It works. So this mindfulness practice, it's always, you know, in this tradition, it's at, and what the Buddha taught, it's at the core of the solution. It's this boundlessness that he taught. It wasn't like pointing at a, you know, some concretized sort of thing. Is just take off the layers and we won't be stuck anymore. So if we can kind of keep in the back of our minds, you know, Dalai Lama's point of view, I think that's really helpful. I mean, the Dalai Lama is so amazing, and just that that beautiful potential we have. By the way, as an aside, there's a movie that I don't know how it's going to be available, but keep your eye out for it. It's called Joy. And it's a kind of like a series of interviews, sort of, with, it's a very interesting, but anyway, Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. And part of it is like they're literally side by side in Dharamsala, and with a one person that's been around Desmond Tutu for years, and just he's a terrific interviewer and really has insight. But they're just so amazing. But what's powerful about the movie is it, because I don't know if you've been around or have any idea what I'm talking about, but they have this mischievous delight with each other. They were here in 2008. Remember that? I don't know how many people were here in Seattle in 2008 when the Circles of Compassion thing was here, and the Dalai Lama was here, and Desmond Tutu was here in Seattle, and they were at the Heckhead Pavilion up on this stage together, and they were just, it was crazy to watch them. They were just giggling and being all mischievous with each other. It was so damn cute. I mean, it's probably one of the cutest things I've ever seen in my entire life. It's just because they really like each other. I mean, they're best of friends. They just deeply admire each other and enjoy each other. Completely straddling that he's an archbishop in Anglican tradition and Dalai Lama's Tibetan Buddhist. It does not matter. But what was particularly powerful about the movie and appropriate to what we're talking about is that a big chunk of the movie is how gnarly it's been. There's a whole bunch of footage about apartheid, about Desmond Tutu being beaten and arrested, about all kinds of horrendous stuff back then. He was a total leader. I didn't quite realize how much of a leader he was. And he was head of the Reconciliation Commission after apartheid ended. And then in terms of the Dalai Lama, there's tons of footage about Chinese soldiers coming in and just burning down monasteries and beating monks and all of that, and how a bunch of stuff about the Dalai Lama, how he had to flee and how hard it was, turned around and looked at Lhasa, at the Potala Palace the last time, and all of that. So it's woven together with all the pain that they've experienced and how joyful they are. And both are true. Pretty amazing. So, you know, we all have trauma and we have pain and we have things we regret and mistakes we've made. And maybe stuff from other lifetimes even, who knows? And it's all real. I mean, you know, we've got to hold it and breathe with it. And that's part of what brings us compassion and able to listen to people and not to be, you know, what am I trying to say, presumptuous in our spirituality. Is that, yeah, we screwed up. Or I screwed up. I can tell you a bunch of stuff I screwed up, you know, and to be able to say, wow, I hurt somebody and know that. And go ahead and find joy and give that too. So that's kind of how this works. And in Tibetan tradition, they say that spiritual life is like a snake in the tube. If you ever heard, like a snake in a tube, you know, once the snake's gotten into the tube, the only way they can go is forward. And that's kind of how it is with all this stuff, you know? Once you get going, you can't go back. I mean, we can see how the complications that caused the trouble was there to go back to. Interesting. A late edition. Whoops, what happened? So this is Corner of the Path, where can't give up. There's no other options. So freedom ahead. And the last obstacle is kind of losing track of inspiration or vision of the Dharma. That's hard, you know? And it's hard. It's hard in 2022. I mean, if we were growing up in Tibet in the 14th century or in Thailand or whatever, and there was awakened beings in our sphere, or at least highly disciplined monastics, a lot, part of why I'm drawn to monastic maybe. But it's hard. It's just hard to keep that vision and to find it and to cultivate it. That's part of why we sit together. So it's hard to do. And this vision, you know, that was so radiantly embodied by the Buddha, so radiantly that when, as some of you know the story, when he first came to Sarnath to teach, the five disciples thought he was a sluggard because he'd been eating, and they would say, oh, that's the Buddha. We're just going to sit here. We're not going to stand up. He's this person, this glutton. And so they were just going to stand up, and then he got close, and he was so radiant and amazing. They were just like awed, and they stood up, and because of what he radiated, like that little thing from the Dhammapada said. So it'd be nice to be around that. And so this transmission thing, it's important, you know, and I think it's, I bring this up because it's something that I think it's good to find ways to do as much as we can, because it is accessible. I mean, in odd ways, it is accessible here in 2022 that other ways it might not be. I mean, for instance, Gil Fronsdal is teaching, as some of you know, 7 a.m., does this, meditates for half an hour and teaches at 7:30, 15 minutes, Monday through Friday, online through IMC. And he's just starting this, he's going to, I know, go on for weeks and weeks and weeks, teaching the Satipatthana Sutta, this extraordinary depth. So you can, you know, contact this very awakened mind, my book, just to keep realigning this whole concept of transmission. It's not so much a Theravada idea, shows up in Mahayana a lot, but it's important. I think it's real important in the path to find ways to connect with that. Find ways that'll light up your sense of direction and help you see what's ahead, where to go. So it takes some sort of like an intelligent targeting and choosing. I'm very fortunate. I'm very fortunate because I'm old, but that meant that I got to be around some of these early, I mean, there was a time when early in my practice when there were a bunch of great Tibetan masters who had come out of 1959 diaspora. I mean, they'd left Tibet already practiced and they hadn't yet died. There were a bunch of people like that. And it was amazing. I mean, it was like, holy crap, pardon my French. There were these like incredibly awakened beings who you could be in the same room with. I mean, not personally, but like Jagatukul Rinpoche, who was a great Nyingma master, died a number of years ago. Kirti Senchab Rinpoche, who I think I've talked about a few times, and he was in retreat for 20 years up in the hills above Dharamsala before the Dalai Lama told him to go start teaching. And then Theravada tradition, Ajahn Buddhadasa, they just radiated, as that sutta said, their attainment. Didn't have to say much, just to be around someone like that. Even in another tradition, just to jump traditions a little bit, which I do once in a while, Muktananda, I had a chance, I spent some time in India with Muktananda when he was alive, and they do this thing in Hindu tradition called darshan, where the teacher will just sit there, doesn't say a word, just sits there. And I can remember like him just sitting there in the afternoon, sort of in this courtyard of the ashram for hours. He wouldn't move. Nobody would move. They could hardly move. It was so intense because he was just amazing. So that's important to have us have a sense of direction, but it's something kind of to seek, to look for, however it works for you. And there's people out there, you know, I think that's why I'm hanging around now that we talk about it with these monks some, because they got something. So, you know, for everyone here, you know, just think about that. How are you going to do that? How can you, I mean, we do that with each other. You know, everyone has what Goldie shared. That was part of that. You know, we do that with each other, which is so beautiful that here in this weird little digital circle, we do that with each other. And, you know, I know a lot of, there's all kinds of stuff online and, you know, there's some really profound things happening out there that, if you click into them and choose to make them a priority, it's sort of a strangely glorious time here in the middle of COVID in terms of what's available, and some very seasoned deep practitioners out there sharing what they see. And you can actually, you know, I mean, it used to be like almost impossible to hear Gil Fronsdal because his retreats were booked up and overbooked and waitlisted and you just couldn't do it. Now it's like, you can. That's so cool. So just do that. Okay. Now I'm almost done. A few tips, then I'll stop. So in terms of your own practice, you know, don't give up. Just continue and focus on growth. You know, think of it in terms of growth, not experience, and just don't worry about how it feels. Because it's not about feeling good or feeling bad. I mean, we have a sense of faith, sort of confidence that freedom will emerge, but difficult in the beginning sometimes. So that's okay. Peeling the onion, that's okay. So just stick with it. That's what Chagatulu Rinpoche always said, he had like, he'd always say, don't give up, don't give up. This great Tibetan master. That was one of his core teachings, was don't give up, because he knew Westerners. So he was trying to keep, he very, very much taught Westerners. He was very unusual how much he focused on Westerners. He was in California and had his big sense still there. And, but so don't give up. And kind of what I'm just saying, the second thing is just wherever you can, avail yourself of the chance to have contact with beings who stretch you, you know, who's further along the path, or maybe it's even some aspect of who they are is further along the path than we are, and be stretched. Let them stretch you, you know, make contact, see where it takes you, see where it inspires you. And, you know, third thing is just realize opportunities for insight in every moment. Just keep cultivating mindfulness, which means just being aware, and treasure the moments, the little ridiculous moments, you know, when you step off a bus and you feel yourself step off the bus, or you step back in the grocery line to let someone with two things go ahead of you and there's this happiness in them. You know, whatever you do, just keep treasuring those moments. Each one is astonishing and beautiful, and those keep us moving ahead, because it's apart from all the hindrances, all the distractions that would have us go elsewhere. And lastly, you know, never forget how impermanent life is and how certain death is. It's kind of like a pick-me-up. You know, the tonic of practice is we don't have too much time. And so cruise control is not an option. Or it is, but it's kind of a ill-chosen option. So have it pull us on the path. One of my very, very first teachers, God, so far back I can't remember. That's amazing. I really can't. But that's okay. A Tibetan master, and he would say, practice like your hair's on fire. And he said that a lot. Genla Rinpa. So I always remember that. Okay. That's what I got. I'll ring the bell for a second here.